Hi, this is Simon Bown. For years, I've explored the mysteries of near-death experiences, reincarnation, and life beyond this one. Now, I've gathered some of the most compelling cases into my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife. This book features 30 extraordinary near-death experiences, each one backed by verifiable details that defy explanation. These are more than just personal stories. They offer real evidence that consciousness continues beyond death. Through these accounts, you'll hear about profound moments of connection, insights from beyond, and experiences that challenge everything we think we know about life and the afterlife. Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, will be published on March 24th, and the Kindle version is now available for pre-order. Welcome to Our Paranormal Afterlife. This is Our Paranormal Afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bown. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I'm talking to Gregory Shushan about his book, Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. Gregory is the leading authority on near-death experiences and afterlife beliefs across cultures and throughout history. He is an award-winning author affiliated with Birmingham Newman University, University of Winchester, Marion University, and the Parapsychology Foundation. He is a former researcher at the University of Oxford and University of Wales. Hi, Gregory. Thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilization: The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. And one thing I noticed at the beginning of the book, you say, I'm not just asking a question in order to be provocative and imply an unsubstantiated, controversial answer. So it's like you're saying, this isn't just a guess or something. You've got more to it than that.
Exactly, yeah. And I put that in there because there's so much out there these days where the attitude is I don't have any evidence, but I'm just asking the question. And I wanted to make a real distinction between what I'm doing, that this actually is based on evidence and based on years of actual scholarly research, rather than a kind of speculation about, ancient aliens or whatever, and something that's rather an uninformed speculation based on a personal observation or something somebody saw on the internet or whatever. And I see every day online things like these AI generated images of Egyptian sphinxes that are part mechanical, and people are saying, oh, this is proof that the aliens were ancient Egyptians and that they built the pyramids. So I'm hoping to kind of combat some of that kind of thinking, actually, by showing how actual scholarship is done.
There's a lot of stuff in the book. I know you quote a lot of other people, so it shows how much research you've been doing. You kind of say in the book that near-death experiences have influenced spiritual and religious beliefs around the world for hundreds, well, thousands of years, isn't it? It goes right back to the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the argument. And I sort of came to this conclusion in a couple of different ways. One was... So in Egypt, for example, there are no accounts of near-death experience, just to kind of get that out of the way. So I was mostly comparing religious texts that describe what the afterlife is like in these different ancient civilizations. So it was Egypt, Sumer, China before Buddhism, India before Hinduism. So the Vedic period, which was like the sort of root tradition that Hinduism grew out of. And then the Aztec and Mayan civilizations in Mesoamerica. So they were essentially, for the most part, arose independently of each other, but at the same time sort of constitute the world's earliest religious thoughts about the afterlife, if you look at each area separately. So what I wanted to do is look at the degree to which their beliefs in the afterlife, and especially the journey to the other world, correspond to near-death experiences. And if they do, because there's pretty much no chance that the idea spread from one particular area to another, then I thought, you know, near-death experience was a reasonable explanation to explain those similarities across cultures.
Nowadays, we have, you could say, a lot of people having near-death experiences. That's down to this amazing medical techniques that we have nowadays. So I suppose in the ancient times, people would have had NDEs. It would have been quite rare if people spontaneously came back from the dead.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And I think because of that, people were seen as particularly special and unique and sort of like prophets. It would have given them a special status, the fact that they came back to life and talked about all these experiences that, they had in the other world. And so therefore what they had to say probably would have been listened to a bit more closely than the many near-death experiences that we have testimonies from these days. A lot of people just dismiss what they say, some because they don't believe it or some because it doesn't match their conception of what an NDE should be like. But I think in other earlier civilizations, and indeed many civilizations still active today and different kinds of societies, I think they put more of a value on the experience because of its scarcity, as you said.
So you go back as far as ancient Egypt, but before that, is there a point that's been spotted in human history where kind of like religion or spirituality began? Or as far as we know, man has always believed in an afterlife?
I think we've probably always believed in an afterlife, but no, as far as the very clear evidence goes, where we can understand what these people were thinking and writing about and their thought processes. And I mean, there's always some kind of mystery because it's Egypt, especially in Sumer, these are ancient civilizations that don't have any modern forebears. They don't have anybody who still practices these religions, or the languages have been dead for thousands of years. So there's some degree of speculation, but we know, you know, we can read the text because they've been translated, and we know for the most part what their religious systems were like. But earlier on, when we don't have any texts at all, it's really a matter of speculation. And there's a really interesting example of this. There's a lot of people will say there's evidence for an afterlife because there was a burial that had a sword in it and remnants of a feast and various other things that a person might need in the other world. But there's a paper in the 1960s, I think, by an archaeologist named Peter Ucko. And he showed that in different cultures around the world, all these kinds of burial practices are sometimes linked to things that have nothing to do with an afterlife. So, for example, a sword in a grave might be to destroy the power that sword might have had in it, to keep it from being a dangerous weapon anymore, and then burying it with a person. But it was not to accompany them to the other world. And the same with remnants of feasting. It was a funerary feast in honor of the dead, but it wasn't about that person having sustenance in the other world. So while, you know, it's very possible that some of these burials had something to do with the afterlife, there's just no way of knowing without the text. So that's why I kind of tried to keep it to the civilizations where we know their religious beliefs about the afterlife.
When you look at these civilizations, can you see a clear development of their spiritual beliefs, that like they start out quite basic and then just get much, much more complex?
No, in fact, that's an interesting thing about it. They really do seem to appear fully formed in all of their complexity, sometimes esoteric sort of diversity, things that I think because we're not part of the culture, it's really difficult for us to understand some of what's going on. So, for example, in Egypt, there's this idea that the soul goes to the other world and dwells for eternity in a paradise kind of area called the Field of Rushes, or the Field of Offerings. And they're kind of living in this, you know, bucolic paradise with, you know, hunting birds and everything is opulent and wonderful. But at the same time, the afterlife is portrayed as an eternity of traveling through the celestial realm with the sun god Re, and then traveling down through the underworld as Osiris and back again, and this kind of continual circuit of the sun. So obviously there can't be two eternities simultaneously. So we don't know if these fates are dependent on the individual or if it's a more kind of transcendent, omnipresent sort of state where they're experiencing everything at once, or if it's just a difference in the type of text and the way it was described in different texts. It's just all, some of it is pretty obscure. Some scholars have thought maybe it was a Northern Egyptian and a Southern Egyptian tradition, and they kind of merged in this uneasy way. But I'm skeptical about that because this is a you know, texts that were written for thousands of years and were sustained for thousands of years. So I think that there had to have been an internal consistency as far as Egyptian thought went. I think they knew what they were talking about, even if we don't.
And you find that even though these different parts of the world that you studied have this basic kind of spiritual afterlife belief, it's not that they influenced each other over time. They all have their own independent source.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they all seem to have emerged basically without, at least not prominent influence from the others. So, you know, Egypt and Sumer had trade between each other, and then Sumer and India had some kind of trade, or actually at least a bit later they did, that region. But as far as, you know, actual evidence of similarities between religions in the sense of gods and myths and things like that, there's really no evidence that there was, that these were, you know, mutually influencing cultures. They really did sort of evolve independently. And there's only so far we can take that argument because, for example, Egyptian civilization was made up of various peoples from different parts of the Nile Valley and the desert, and they kind of merged together and gradually over time formed this religion and this culture. But as far as we can tell in the records, it kind of all emerged as what we know of as Egyptian.
And are there tales of specific individuals like we might have today of near-death experiences, or is it more, it kind of looks like a near-death experience, what they're describing, but they're not saying it's coming from this one person?
Yeah, that's a great point. I meant to mention that earlier, actually, when I said there were kind of two strands of evidence. So one is the descriptions of the afterlife in the religious texts, which were essentially designed as guidebooks so the soul of the dead could know what to expect in the other world. But the implication is that obviously somebody must have been there to be able to come back and write about it and describe it and to have this kind of knowledge to share. But then the other strand is are the accounts of people who did travel to the other world and return. And there seems to be a sort of two strands of that. One is the very obviously overtly mythological strand. For example, there's in ancient Sumer, there's the myth of Inanna, where the goddess Inanna, she's associated with love and with Venus. She travels to the underworld to overthrow Eresh-ki-Gala, the reigning queen of the underworld. And there's a real story and a plot behind it. And there's all these kind of supernatural events and plot devices, reversal of fortune, ironies, things like that. But then we've got accounts that actually seem to be more like an NDE. And unsurprisingly, those accounts are associated with historical individuals, people who actually did live. You know, Inanna was a goddess, but then on the other hand, we have Gilgamesh, who was an early Sumerian king. His Sumerian name was Bilgamesh, and he really was a historical king. We have a text about him called The Death of Bilgamesh. This might be the world's first recorded NDE. It describes how he's lying on his deathbed. He leaves his body, travels to the other world. He meets the sun god Utu, who is obviously a being of light, radiating light. He also meets his deceased relatives. He has a kind of life review because the deities in the other world kind of evaluate his deeds on earth in order to figure out what to do with him, you know, whether he's going to go back to earth or whether he's going to be turned into a god or have a positive or a negative afterlife fate. And then there's a kind of banquet held in his honor, and the gods decide that he's going to be a judge in the other world when he dies. But for now, he's going back to his body. So to me, that's a pretty clearly an NDE, even if it does have clearly Sumerian mythological elements. We don't have people in modern NDEs saying they met Utu and Sumerian gods. They say a being of light or Jesus or the Buddha or Muhammad or whatever.
Do you find that they suggest that everybody will have an afterlife? Or is there a time in these cultures where they're saying it's only for the kings or it's only for the wealthy or something?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And another quite tricky one. I think Egypt is a good example, once again, where the pyramid text, which is their earliest descriptions of the afterlife and the earliest sort of guidebook to the other world, they're found only in the pyramids of kings. So there's been this, you know, the kind of thought around that for decades has been the afterlife was only for the royalty. It was only reserved for this highest elite level of society. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's more of a case of the highest levels of society were the people who were literate and had the money to be able to afford pyramids with stone carvings with these texts on them. I think the beliefs were probably more widespread, but the texts weren't yet available. And so part of the reason I think this is because in the descriptions of the afterlife in the pyramid texts, you have some people who become servants of Osiris in the other world. You have some people who are threatened by demons and annihilated. And then you have people who live in these more paradise kind of states. And you have judges. There's lots of references to judges. So there has to be people to judge in the other world. And with all these diverse faiths, I think, implies that there were different types of people to be judged. And then later on, as people became more literate, as the texts became more widespread, we find them written in coffins. That's when they become known as the coffin texts. And then they become changed a little bit. There's more descriptions of possible negative fates and clearer descriptions of pathways. And it's more sort of systematized. And then even later, when it becomes the Book of the Dead, which everyone's more familiar with, and then the later New Kingdom books, there's even more stress on heaven and hell and punishment. And I think that's because as the texts became more available to the general populace, they're no longer just on pyramids. Anyone can have them on a bit of papyrus. They then become used by the elite as a tool of control, which is one of these, you know, very old explanations for afterlife beliefs, that it's this elite tool of control. So I don't think afterlife beliefs emerged from that impulse, but I think they were manipulated in that way later as they became more democratized, basically.
If we were to look at the Americas and ancient Egypt, do you see things that are the same, these two sides of the Atlantic, but it's like it's too specific to be coincidence? There must have been a source from somewhere.
I do, yeah. And I think part of that is, well, first of all, you've got the kinds of elements that I mentioned, the, you know, traveling through darkness, meeting a being of light, your deceased relatives, an evaluation of your life on Earth, often seeing kind of beautiful or pastoral sorts of landscapes, and then in some cases, a return to the body, depending on the nature of the text. But, you know, all these descriptions are in a death and afterlife context. So it's not like, you know, it's not a comparison between two totally different types of texts. So the context itself already is important. And then the fact that there's these sort of 9 or 10 elements that seem to be transposed into every one of these cultures, I think is pretty compelling that, you know, the ancient source is a near-death experience cross-culturally.
So what kind of basic things do you see? Is it something where they perhaps have a life review in all these different cultures?
Life review that's an interesting one because so as much similarity as there is, there's also a lot of diversity, both in the text and in near-death experiences themselves. So the kind of popular conception of an NDE with a life review is that we experience everything that happened to us in life, everything that we did, the ways that we made other people feel. You know, if we injured someone, we're going to be feeling their pain during our life review. But it's all sort of happening at once. And people who have NDEs in the contemporary West describe it in this way, that It's this almost onslaught. There's not even a sort of chronological outplaying. It's just simultaneous. Every event of your life and every feeling that you've had, that's practically absent in the ancient texts, as well as in indigenous societies across cultures. There's very frequently, there's some kind of evaluation of the person's life. So the, in the Bilgamesh text, for example, they talked about whether, you know, he built temples to the gods. He lived a sort of pious life. He lived a life in service of the state, those kinds of things, which were, you know, the ideal positive behavior. And then there's a Native American example where there's the person who has the NDE, he's a Native American chief, and he sees in the other world a man sitting behind a desk who's like an authority figure, I guess like the God figure or the being of light or whatever. And on a wall behind him is a photograph of himself, of the guy having the NDE. And somehow that photograph embodies all of his life's actions and his life history, but it's not really a life review. So we have this concept of like the theme is the same across cultures, but the way it's expressed differs quite widely. And that's mirrored in, again, in near-death experiences and in the afterlife beliefs.
Something we find in modern near-death experiences, it seems, with the life review, it's the person who's reviewing their life is the judge. And nobody else is judging them. It's like if they have beings of light with them, they're supportive, not judgmental. Right. So do you think this thing of some kind of higher power judging you in the afterlife is invented by man on Earth, so to speak, as a means of control or something?
I do think that, yeah. And I mean, we do have obviously plenty of texts with the gods judging people. And I mentioned this panel of gods in the Sumerian texts. But, you know, when you look at the very earliest ones, so for example, in Egypt, the soul of the dead goes to the underworld and meets the lord of the dead, Osiris, who is also the judge of the dead. And people are probably familiar with these images of Osiris standing next to the scales that's weighing the heart of the dead against the feather of Maat. And Maat was like the principle of justice and order in the universe. So that's very clearly a judgment scene. But at the same time, the texts are very clear that the soul of the dead is one and the same as Osiris. So you are actually the judge who is undertaking this judgment of yourself. So it really is self-judgment. And at the same time, it's also an encounter with your own corpse, because the soul of the dead sees the corpse of Osiris in the other world, and it's described as basically rotting. They refer to it as the efflux of Osiris, which is, you know, the liquids draining from his corpse, not to be disgusting. But and so because the soul of the dead is associated with Osiris, that's really, I think, like symbolic of an out-of-body experience when somebody leaves the body and they see their own body lying there. But most importantly, the theme behind that is consistent with NDEs, because when people have an NDE and they see their own body, that's the thing that makes them think, hang on a minute, I'm alive and I'm here seeing myself, but I'm also dead because I can see my dead body lying there. So it's the realization that they've transcended death, basically, that they've survived the death of their body. And in the ancient Egyptian texts, it's the same message that once you understand that corpse of Osiris is also you, then you can kind of progress to the next phase of the afterlife. And it's a step towards the enlightenment and the, you know, meeting the sun god and carrying on through the afterlife that occurs next.
So I assume there must have been distressing NDEs as well, because where would the idea of hell come from? And I suppose they could link that to being judged.
The earliest ones are less about punishments. They're not so much put in a physical way that, you know, something's going to happen to your subtle body in the other world. It's more like a fear of annihilation, a fear of non-existence, which I think is really interesting. And it also feeds into the idea that as time goes on, the texts were used as a tool of control. So by the time we get to moving over to China for a second, you know, the Chinese afterlife was an area called the Yellow Springs. And that was a kind of morally, it wasn't a morally determined place. It wasn't like a heaven or a hell. As time grew on, it became a hellish place. But there wasn't any kind of, you know, judgment and punishment. And then later we get these descriptions of basically the hellish realm, punishment is going to fit the crime. So if you gossiped about people, you're going to have an iron rod shoved through your tongue. If you strike your parents, you're going to have your arm lopped off. So all these very graphic descriptions of punishments that just didn't occur in the earliest texts. But I do think you might have, you know, you might be right that there is probably negative NDEs, or NDEs with negative psychological states that fed in to these ideas of annihilation or something to fear in the afterlife if you don't get a more sort of positive, mystical, transcendent experience.
So another common thing of near-death experiences is this tunnel experience. Do they talk about a tunnel when you die?
There are a lot of descriptions of darkness and gates in the underworld and things like that, which are sort of, you know, analogous to tunnels. But the rushing through a dark tunnel with a light at the end is, again, practically unknown in a lot of these societies. I think it's a case of the idea is the same. Once again, it's transitioning from this world to the next and a means of getting from here to there. But the actual architecture or the landscape of it differs. A good example of that is actually from Hawaii. There's a 19th century Hawaiian account, a few of them, in fact, that the person having the NDE describes walking along a path, and they will even say, I could see the footprints of the sand of the thousands of souls who went to the spirit village before me. So rather than rushing through a tunnel, it's walking along the path. And then one woman even said, as I was walking to the spirit village, I could see somebody returning on the path next to me. And that was somebody who had an NDE and was now going back to their body. And the woman telling the story is on her way to her NDE.
So do you find it's the smaller kind of cultures that would talk about walking along a path to get to the other side, and it's the bigger cultures that talk about going through darkness?
Yeah, that does seem to be the case in a lot of small-scale societies in Polynesia. Some Native American ones, yeah, they do talk about a path to the spirit village rather than rushing through darkness or having to negotiate a series of gates with gatekeepers and things like that, like you have in Egypt. But at the same time, I should stress, those accounts are actual NDEs, the ones from the small scale societies I'm talking about. They were presented as a living person or even a verbatim account from the person who had the NDE talking to anthropologists or missionaries or explorers and telling them about either their own personal experience or somebody in recent memory who had the NDE.
And were the missionaries very receptive to these kind of descriptions, or was it, you know, kind of a heresy or something?
Yeah, they saw it as, you know, that they came from the devil and that these people were deluded by Satan and all this sort of thing. But it's an interesting dynamic because it shows that near-death experiences could sort of be used almost as a tool of resistance by the indigenous people, partly as a way of almost like a symbolic death and rebirth of their own culture, a kind of symbolic renewal. So as they're being preached to by these missionaries and told that your beliefs come from the devil and all this, there's a Native American example where they're talking to a French missionary. This is in the 18th century. And they tell him, we actually don't believe what you're telling us about eternal hellfire and suffering and damnation, because for one thing, we know somebody who, you know, a couple of years ago died and came back to life. And he told us about what the afterworld really is like. And you're talking about something that, you know, may have happened thousands of years ago in a place that's thousands of miles away that we've never even heard of. So why should we believe this alien distant culture talking about the distant past when we have somebody more recently who has actually been there and lived to tell about it? So they prioritized basically the wisdom that their people were getting from near-death experiences over the dogma of, you know, this foreign colonial power. And that helped to some degree with their resistance and to maintain their, you know, cultural integrity, basically.
Did you find that right across the world, they talk about the afterlife as being an idealized version of Earth?
They do. Yeah, that's quite common. And again, it corresponds with what the idealized, what the ideal of Earth would be in a particular culture. So, you know, the Egyptian afterlife is going to have these plentiful marshes in the Nile Valley, and they've got the same types of animals there, the kinds of birds that they would hunt in Egypt, and they've got crocodiles and all the rest. Whereas, you know, in Native American society, they're going to have the kinds of animals and landscapes you would find in the Americas. So they would have buffalo, and it'd be like, you know, the happy hunting grounds sort of thing. And that's also reflects what we find in near-death experiences, I think. So again, it's this idea that the afterlife ideas are mirroring conceptually the same thing that's happening in NDEs.
Hello, this is me, Simon. Did you know that during a past life regression, you can meet with your spirit guide? I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom, and I've guided many clients to a spiritual encounter with their guide. If you would like to ask me how a session would work for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. So did you ever come across any stories of what we might call veridical NDEs, you know, these verified ones?
I did, yeah. A couple of them. Some are out-of-body experiences. There's a Native American example where the man leaves his body while he's on the battlefield, and he can see what's going on around the vicinity of his body. And then he travels to the spirit village, and he's trying to talk to people, and he's unable to get through to them. And he gradually realizes that that he's still alive, but he was able to see things on the battlefield from a vantage point that he obviously wouldn't be able to see from his body. But there's a really interesting one also from ancient China, from I think the 8th century BCE, where a man has a near-death experience. He's like a sort of community politician, a local ruler, and he goes to the other world. And there's a lot of similarities with what we see as think of as an NDE. You know, he leaves the body, he goes and spends time with what they call the Emperor of Heaven. So there's some kind of deity there. There's his relatives, there's prophecies and various other elements. But then there's really unique things. So, for example, two bears appear and they go to attack the emperor. And the guy having the NDE shoots the bears to save the emperor, and he saves his life. And so in return, the emperor, you know, gives him good favor and tells him he'll go back to Earth and he will have a positive afterlife and things like that. But before the guy goes back to his body, he notices that standing next to the emperor is a small boy. So he goes back to his body, fast forward a few years later, he's walking down the street in a different village from his own, and there's a man in his pathway who won't move out of his way, and he's making eye contact and kind of deeply gazing at him as in this kind of recognition sort of way. And the man says, you know, you look a little familiar. Why won't you get out of my way? What's going on here? And the guy says, on this particular day a few years ago, you were in heaven. You killed these two bears. You saved the emperor. And I know this because I was the little boy standing at the emperor's side. So this boy had now grown up and recognized the guy having the NDE at the time. And this was seen by the Chinese authorities as a validation of near-death experiences, basically. And the account was lodged like in the official government Bureau of Records, and it's signed, and everybody who was involved is, you know, they're noted with their profession and their village, you know, highly bureaucratic sort of description of what happened, and yeah, formally lodged with the government records.
So with talking about government records and the pyramid texts and things, is there any danger that perhaps because it's an ancient, unused language, or any of these cultures that there may be stuff lost in translation and it could be misinterpreted?
Absolutely, yeah. There's been a very focused, nonstop program of translation and retranslation ever since the Rosetta Stone was deciphered. For example, the pyramid texts have had, you know, three or four translations, and there's still a new one that comes out every 4 or 5 years as knowledge of the language increases. But having said that, if you compare the most recent example to, you know, the first example, well, not counting Wallace Budge, Budge is practically, I wouldn't say useless, but I would not recommend anyone to use Budge for any Egyptian text. But as you know, if you compare, one from the 60s or 70s to ones from the present, they're not a million miles off. So the language is basically understood, and it's the same with Sumerian. There's a consensus of what these texts are saying. I think the bigger issue is what they meant to the minds of the people who wrote them and who were reading them, because there are layers of symbolism and context that I think we're just not getting. But having said that, when you have, when you have these descriptions, again, that are in an afterlife context, and they have these elements that are, you know, transposed onto NDEs, then I think there's not really any room for debate there. I think it's just a matter of comparing what is there with what is in NDEs. And to me, that's evidence. To me, that's an evidential, rigorous way of doing a comparison cross-culturally.
And are there dangers of imposing our modern viewpoint upon them?
I think there are, but I approach this with a sort of open-minded attitude, perfectly willing to be proven wrong, that, you know, or to find, you know, one civilization that the model didn't conform to, and look at them as an outlier. In fact, that would have been in some ways more interesting. But a good example of that is with ancient Sumer. There's the kind of received wisdom in Assyriology, which is the study of Mesopotamian civilizations, that the Sumerian afterlife was this vague, shadowy underworld, this kind of half-life where people were only barely having experiences, just kind of wandering in semi-darkness, confused. And that was how, you know, the majority of people would spend their eternity after death. And I thought I didn't want to rely on other people's summaries of what the afterlife was like in these civilizations. So I went back and looked at the original texts in translation, obviously, but I read them afresh. And I found that there were actually lots and lots of descriptions of light, beings radiating light, deceased relatives. There are a lot of judges in the Sumerian afterlife realm, which again implies that there are people to be judged and that there are diverse fates. So some people have a positive one, some people have a negative one. There's descriptions of feasting and having banquets and things like this. So I was, on the one hand, it ended up validating what I was writing about NDEs and started making me think that actually the Sumerian example is not an outlier. They actually do conform to the NDE model hypothesis. But it was also interesting to just kind of find that, you know, what I was reading was flying in the face of a couple hundred years of Assyriology. And I started looking more deeply into what scholars were writing about this. And they would write things like, because this particular text has these positive elements and judges, we can't consider it an accurate description of what they believed about the afterlife. So, and so to me, that was, that's more like we need to dismiss that because it conflicts with our paradigm. It's not looking at what they actually wrote. And to me, that's not a kind of sound approach to looking at these texts.
Yeah, because the lives of these people from such a long time ago was so different to ours. I suppose in some ways it's really hard to put ourselves in their shoes and look at the world in the same way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of them would be quite offensive to us. There's one Sumerian text that it describes what all the different levels of people in society would happen, what they would experience in the afterlife. And there's one section where it's all dependent on how many sons a person has. So the person with one son will maybe have bread and water. The person with two sons will have slightly better afterlife, and, you know, all the way up to the person who has 12 sons as this amazing paradise realm. And then a woman who is beyond childbearing years will have to spend eternity sitting in the corner as useless as a broken pot. So it's not all love and light, you know.
So were there any cultures that you started looking into and you discovered they just don't really have an afterlife belief?
I ran across none of the ancient civilizations. But when I was looking at indigenous religions cross-culturally in the small-scale societies, what used to be called tribal societies, I did find a few. But it's not clear if they outright did not have afterlife beliefs or if they didn't want to talk about them to the anthropologist or the missionary, or if there just wasn't enough information about them. Because sometimes I would run across an example where an anthropologist would say, yes, these people believe this, that, and the other, and this is what their afterlife is like. And then a missionary would write, these people have no beliefs in an afterlife. So there's conflicting information, even within our sources.
Did you find that there was a universal point in these experiences where there may be a barrier? Because we see this in modern near-death experiences where people say that there was something there they couldn't cross and they had to return.
Yeah, that does often seem to be the case. There's some kind of gate or wall or just a place that they can't pass. They can see the spirit village, but they can't get to it. Yeah, there's always a particular stage that they reach that they can't pass, because if they do, then they would have to stay in the other world forever. And by not doing that, then that's the way they have an NDE. That's how they come back.
And do you find that people were given a choice to come back, or they were just directed to come back and they had no choice?
For the most part, that information isn't really given. They just either wake up in their body or they're sent back to their body, and we don't know why. There are a few examples, I think, again, with some Native American cultures where there is a choice, but they're pretty rare. But there is an interesting cultural division between the reason for being sent back to the body, the kind that we're familiar with in contemporary Western world. It's usually because you need to take care of your loved ones, or you need to finish this life. It's just not your time to die. You need to fulfill something on earth that you're meant to do here. But in other cultures, in India, for example, a lot of the NDEs describe a case of mistaken identity. So they would, you know, if I were to have an NDE, I'd get to the other world and the being of light would tell me, we got the wrong Gregory Shushan. We actually meant to get the one who lives in upstate New York or whatever. Go back to your body. So then I'd wake up in my body and this poor other person who happens to share my name would then, you know, die permanently. And that's something, you know, it's just not found. I've never seen that in a Western account.
That's interesting. It's like some kind of clerical error. Or maybe the new guy's started out and he hasn't got it right.
Yeah. I mean, the basic thing of it's not your time to die is the same. But the reason for it being not your time to die is definitely cultural. And I don't know if that's... I tend to not feel like that's something that really happens in both of those cases. I tend to think that it's a cultural plot making about what happened to the person, that they were sent back to their body. And in the process, you know, maybe they're trying to make sense of it. And that's a way that it makes sense to them. And maybe the mistaken identity idea makes more sense to them than, you know, in our more individualistic society, it's about me. What do I need to do on earth? What do I need to fulfill? Do I need to come back and tell people about the afterlife and care for the loved ones? Versus, you know, they just got the wrong one.
So there's consistencies across these cultures and information that's consistent with near-death experiences today. But did you see anything that was a significant difference between the cultures, that something that really stood out?
Once you kind of strip away the cultural symbolizing, I would say no, actually. I would say they're all, the themes are all there, again, kind of, you know, transposed from the near-death experience onto each one of these, you know, ancient civilizations. And to me, that was really surprising and profound, actually.
So when you looked at these civilizations, the ancient Egyptian was thousands of years ago, but you may have had traditions in America that sprang up hundreds of years ago, maybe 1,000 years or 2,000 years after the Egyptians.
Right.
So did you look at them that they, you didn't think about how far apart those timings were? You just thought from the beginning of their civilization, the development of it. Am I making sense? It's not like you thought, well, the American came up 2,000 years after the Egyptians, so they may have...
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. in anthropology, there's the term used is early civilizations. And in that sense, you know, the Maya civilization in Mesoamerica are just as early as the Egyptian, even though chronologically they're separated by thousands of years as far as their origins go. So what it means is basically that it's the earliest form of the class-based society that emerged independently in that particular area of the world. So, it was this kind of independent emergence of each one, again, without any influence from Egypt to Mesoamerica. But they're kind of on a par because the way in which they emerged is comparable. They both emerged separately at these and organically in one particular place, and the culture kind of grew from there.
So is there much mention of reincarnation, or does that come later?
It does come a bit later in the Indian texts, especially. It's interesting there because with the Vedas and the Upanishads, we have descriptions of, well, we have we don't have clear documentary NDEs, but we have medical texts that attest to NDEs. They basically say, if somebody is dying and travels to the other world, here's how to go and bring them back. So it's this kind of soul retrieval medical text, basically, that talks about NDEs. but then we've got also this kind of string of stories, or legends, maybe. I hesitate to call them actual NDEs, but they have obviously similarities, of a little boy traveling to the other world and coming back to life and talking about his experiences there. The reason I don't count them as real NDEs is they're not presented as documentary, and they kind of involve, once again, these kind of plot elements and the behaviors of gods, and they are more like stories rather than just an account. But as time goes on in India, as reincarnation gets introduced into the discussion a bit more, these accounts kind of taper off, and we don't really have as much evidence for near-death experiences or other world journey travel, because the focus really shifts to reincarnation at a certain point, which I think is pretty interesting. It kind of shows that there was a diversity of beliefs, and the Upanishads was almost like this kind of transitional era that incorporates both. But then from then onwards, you do still have journeys to the other world in the sense that they're like these intermediate stages from your first life, from life that you're in now, and then prior to your next incarnation. And it's in that intermediate state that the soul is judged. But just like with China, as time goes on, we get these more and more almost loving descriptions of punishments and torments that people will experience in the other world, dependent on their particular transgressions.
So I think you might have mentioned this earlier. It's a thing where the more time passes, the more you hear about punishments.
Right, exactly. And again, that's, it happened in Egypt, in China, and in India. I don't think it's clear in the Aztec and Mayan case, but in the others, it certainly is.
So I was thinking that maybe reincarnation became something because there were children who were remembering their past lives. And so reincarnation came up from that, just as the afterlife beliefs came up from NDEs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and an interesting thing about that too is, I mentioned this idea of the intermission state between incarnations. Even with the children who remember past lives, which have been researched by Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker and other people at University of Virginia, there are cases where they talk about the intermission state. So they will actually remember the death of their previous personality and how that the soul of that person traveled to the other world, saw their body below, met a being of light, met deceased relatives and all that. And then rather than coming back to their body and having an NDE, they end up going into a new body. And then for a brief period of time, they have, the memories of their previous self. So the idea that the intermission memory of the death and intermediate state mirrors near-death experiences, I think is pretty interesting and compelling.
So I noticed in the book, you say that some of the earlier medieval European accounts often do not conform to the image of the afterworld that was commonly accepted.
Right. Yeah. Some of them are, actually a lot of them are, follow the sort of trope of, as which later became typical of Dante's Divine Comedy, where they meet a particular guide or psychopomp and he guides them through the other world and gives them a tour. And it's this very systematic sort of story. But others have these elements that they are not particularly common of medieval Christianity, and including sort of transcendent feelings rather than being separate from the divine. You're kind of at one with the divine. And also, I think, just the idea of an individual dying and coming back to life and having had direct contact, a direct spiritual experience. It was okay for these monks and nuns, but in general, I think that didn't really become incorporated into Christianity, which I find interesting, given that Christianity is kind of predicated on the death and rebirth of Jesus Christ. You would think that it would be maybe NDEs would be a maybe more prominent theme in the religion.
So are there other people who are looking into this thing of near-death experiences and ancient civilizations, or are you a pioneer here?
I never thought of it in that way, but I guess I am sort of a pioneer. I mean, there have been a few people who have looked at NDEs cross-culturally, and even in Raymond Moody's Life After Life, he mentions the myth of Ur from Plato. But as far as, looking in depth at the ancient civilizations and their beliefs in terms of NDEs and kind of drawing all the evidence together for NDEs around the world, I'm the main person doing it, really.
And do you almost feel like, why hasn't somebody done this before?
I do feel that way, absolutely. And, the whole idea of people's afterlife beliefs being based on these kinds of experiences, to me, it's not really controversial because I'm not claiming that near-death experiences are even evidence for an afterlife or that they're evidence of a dying brain. It's kind of independent of what the nature of NDEs are. I'm accepting that these are experiences people have because we have accounts from them from throughout history and all over the world. But it's interesting that in Western scholarship, in anthropology and religious studies, this idea has kind of cropped up here and there, and it's then been completely forgotten. For example, Edward Burnett Tylor, who was an anthropologist in the 19th century, I think in 1871, he wrote something like, there are examples from around the world of people who die and come back to life and talk about the wonders that they saw in the other world. And he speculated that their beliefs might come from these experiences. So he mentions this like in a sentence or two. It's forgotten for 50 years. Then Andrew Lang mentions it without any reference to Tylor. It's forgotten again. So nobody really explored it in depth, but it kind of kept cropping up, almost like people were thinking, this is an area to go, but they didn't know how to find the evidence, or they didn't, near-death experiences wasn't, the term didn't exist. It wasn't known as a common thing, really. So, and then James Mooney, and who wrote the book about the ghost dance in the Native American cultures, he made a distinction between dreams shamanic journeys and near-death experiences, even though he didn't call them that. And he found that the Native Americans themselves also made that distinction, and that they gave priority to NDEs because of their spontaneous nature and because of the depth and realism of them. So I'm hoping to kind of, you know, change the narrative a little bit in the history of religions discussion, and to bring this experience more as a forefront. Again, not to claim anything about the experience itself, but to kind of say, you know, this is a missing component of basically the way we understand human thinking about the afterlife and religions themselves.
Well, we've been talking about the book Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, and people can get that on Amazon and other places.
Yeah, it should be available pretty much everywhere, and including in brick and mortar bookshops, hopefully. And if not, they can order them for you.
Do you have a website?
Yeah, my website is gregoryshushan.com, and I'm on all the social media under my full name as well. And I also have a Patreon account if you want to get free books that way and various other benefits.
Great. Well, I'll put links in the show notes. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Great. Thank you, Simon. Always a pleasure.
This week, I was talking to Gregory Shushan about his book, Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations, The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. And if you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And look out for the Our Paranormal Afterlife episodes called Paranormal Stories that are released every week. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.